there have been obviously quite a lot of archaeological sites that have been excavated because they've been in the main line, but wherever possible, HS2's been working along with its contractors to design out impacts where they're off the line but within areas of their land take. And one of the ways they've done that is through preservation of areas, trying to take areas out of the scheme, look at ways they can reduce the impact of building their compounds, or trying to find different ways to create their environmental offset areas. But we've got a certain number of schemes where we've been working with engineers to look at how we can preserve archaeology underneath design elements. So we've had a couple of sites where there's embankments that have been built over the archaeology. So we've been working hard with engineers to look at settlement distribution and settlement data under those embankments and understand whether the archaeology that's going to be underneath them will be robust enough to be preserved within, left underneath the embankment. And that's been really interesting.
Stay tuned to learn more about how construction can work in harmony with archaeology, building our future, but respecting our past.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Welcome to the Breaking Ground podcast. We're back after something of a summer hiatus. I hope you've had a nice holiday. Today's discussion, although it's going to be technical in nature, won't be strictly about engineering or indeed geology. We'll be discussing archaeology and its interfaces with construction. The person providing the expertise today is Jim Williams. Jim's the Senior Science Advisor at Historic England. Jim, you're a Doctor of Archaeology, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Steve. Thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure.
It's a great pleasure. I started life as an archaeologist. I was lucky enough to do an A-level in it. I went to University of Sheffield and did a BSc in Archaeological Science and liked it so much that I stayed there and did a PhD in archaeology as well, looking largely at environmental archaeology and studying them through small mammals in British archaeological sites and caves.
Fantastic. And what influence did Indiana Jones have on your career trajectory?
Very little, but I do have a nice selection of hats that I occasionally roll under garage doors and then grab back as the door shuts.
Fantastic. That's quite the image. And I must say, you are probably our best dressed guest we've ever had on the Breaking Ground podcast. If only people could see the picture of you. Very smart there in your orange tie. So it's fantastic that you've made such an effort, and I know that you've helped me prepare for this podcast with a lot of detail, so thank you so much for that. I suppose the leading question is, why are you here? Why is archaeology important to our listeners? How would you answer that question, Jim?
I think one of the key things to be aware about is that the historic environment and its study through archaeology is an important part of the planning and development process. Archaeology is a key part of construction. And when you find archaeology on construction sites, what you do with it is governed by UK policies and statute, and it's integral to sustainability. So that's kind of the, sort of boring answer, if you like. That's the book answer. I think the answer is that we get to work as archaeologists with engineers and with designers all the time when people are developing on archaeological sites. And, there's a lot of archaeology out there in the country. A lot of development sites have archaeology as a component within that. And having that dialogue between us and making sure we build those relationships is really important to getting those sites to go well.
Yeah, because I think there's often a lot of frustration when you speak to construction people about the role of archaeologists. Inevitably, the word delays come up when you talk about archaeology. I think what I suppose we all need to understand is just how important our history is, and ensuring that we preserve that for the next generation. Because whilst there might not be the time and the resources available to really investigate a particular site in considerable detail at one point in time, the building that we're constructing, the structure that we're putting up, it might only be there for actually quite a short period. And we need to preserve those monuments and artifacts for future generations.
I think you should perhaps be interviewing yourself, Steve, because I think that's okay. A far better answer than the one I gave, and that's absolutely true. And I think from my perspective, I recognise that that there are delays, and that can happen. But actually, what we want to try and do is to ensure that we move that investigation stage up the process so that we don't end up with construction delays. You had Tony Suckling on one of your podcasts, the second one you did, and he talked through the REBA stages and talked about how important it was that developers and clients were sufficiently funding the geotechnical stages and funding them early within those REBA stages. And I think I'd make the same kind of plea to your listeners that, archaeology sits within that same bracket, really. It's really important that what we do is invest in that early involvement, early engagement. And it's that that helps us to avoid those delays and to have smooth passage and smooth working together of archaeology and engineers on site.
Yeah, so at what point do we need to start an archaeological investigation? Because I'm kind of drawing parallels in my mind with something like a UXO investigation. So you do maybe a desktop study, and if the map shows that there's no bombs being dropped within a mile of the site, it's considered low risk, and you probably don't need to do a site-specific magnetometer survey. Is there a similar sort of procedure involved when it comes to archaeology? Because the first thing you do isn't to go out there with some shovels and see what's in the ground, because we wouldn't have enough archaeologists in the country to go around doing that. So when do you know that you need to investigate the site in more detail?
So a lot of the archaeology that takes place is within the planning process. And so a developer is going to need to assemble the information that they take to the local authority. And as you say, UXO is perhaps one of those aspects. Other environmental aspects, the ecology and the archaeology, are also there. And they're the things that the developer will need to demonstrate to the local authority that they've thought about. So they'll often get in touch with an archaeological contractor, get them to carry out a desk-based assessment. So again, a bit like your UXO, they'll be then looking at maps, at records, trying to see what's known about the archaeology of the area, what previous studies have been done, and also pulling in other information like geotechnical information, geological information, trying to create a deposit model of what it might look like below the ground to try and understand what types of deposits we've got. Are we in a floodplain? Are we on a hill? What impact might that have on the preservation? And so they'll then produce that desk-based assessment, which will give an understanding of the presence of archaeology. And then if you've got archaeology in the area, it's likely that you'll then need to go through a series of further stages of assessment. That might involve a geophysical survey, might involve more boreholes, geoarchaeological analysis, looking at the soil, trying to understand how that's changed and developed over time. And then you may go through a process of evaluation, excavation, trial trenches or test pits to have a better understanding of what's there. So it's that same sort of stage process that I think you'd have with, other environmental disciplines as well.
Okay. And that investigation, and certainly the first stage of it, that's a legal requirement, is it, for any construction site that you need to investigate the archaeology.
Within the National Planning Policy Framework, NPPF, heritage is a key aspect of that. And so what you're looking to do is to be able to demonstrate that you understand the significance of any heritage assets on the site and can understand how the scheme might impact on that significance. And when the local authority comes to make a decision on that planning application, they'll be assessing what the heritage assets are, their significance, and balancing any harm to that significance against the public benefit of the scheme. So it's part of that overall planning process that takes place.
Okay. And the role of Historic England in all this, because you mentioned about archaeological contractors, is what? Are they just a sort of a reference body, a group looking after best practice? Tell us a bit more about Historic England and the role they play.
So Historic England is the government's advisor on the historic environment. And so as an organisation, we help people to care for, enjoy and celebrate England's spectacular historic environment. So our role is very much around championing heritage to improve people's lives. And we do that in a number of ways. As a body, we are consulted by local authorities and national government when people are putting in planning applications that have an impact on our designated assets, so our scheduled ancient monuments or grade 2 star or grade 1 listed buildings. And so that's the key role that Historic England might have within the development process. I manage a team of Historic England science advisors, and we're based in our offices across the country, and we give advice to local authority archaeologists who work within the planning process. And we get involved in helping them with the scientific aspects of archaeology that they see on their day-to-day work with applications for development of archaeological sites. So that might be advice on scientific dating, on different methods of geophysical survey, on how to deal with human remains or environmental sampling.
And do you have powers in the same way that maybe the HSE would to stop a site? So let's say there's a site, I know this seems like a really negative example, but I just want to sort of put it out there and understand the power of Historic England. So somebody's found an old Iron Age well or something on a construction site, and the contractors decided, well, to hell with that, we're going to fill it with concrete. What powers have Historic England got to say, no, you can't do that, I'm going to stop the site? Or is it all about advice and actually it's sort of elevated through the council and other bodies?
I'd like to think that's not an example that's likely to happen, because
I'm not speaking from personal experience. I was grabbing at some sort of artifact there. But who would have the authority to?
I mean, in most instances, isolated finds are rare. You know, normally if you've got an archaeological site, if you've got a construction site and an archaeology is present within it, normally you've known about it from the beginning, and therefore you've got a process, you've got an archaeologist on your team, you've got a written scheme of investigation for archaeological work, you've got an archaeological contractor that's working. So if you uncovered archaeological remains, then you know, you'd follow the normal expected process of any find on a site. You'd report it, and you'd report it to the local authority in this case. You say, we found this, and they say, okay, well, that's unexpected. We'll help you deliver that and work out how to resolve that within your planning process. So.
Yeah, there was actually a site I was involved with earlier this year in Northampton. We were due on site about 2 weeks away from site, and they ended up finding, it was something like 1,000 bodies, skeletons, I don't know the age of them, but on this relatively small site. So it's obviously been a burial ground. And the cost of removing them, I think it was about £2,000. So I think the site is that's it. They just sort of packed up the costs were outweighing the benefits, given the sort of the time and costs of removing them. Just a personal example that came into my mind there, but you know, it does show the impact. And
and I think that's it's another great example of why, you know, that early engagement and early site investigation is really important, so you don't get to the point where you've got a piling rig coming 2 weeks' time and you suddenly discover 1,000 bodies. So
yeah, I mean, I suppose that potentially could have been shown up if you'd done enough desk study work and investigated, oh, this used to be a churchyard. You know, it's a pretty safe bet that 500 years ago they were burying people in churchyards. So yeah, maybe they should have seen that one coming. So one of the documents that you recommended that we check out, which unfortunately I haven't had the opportunity to read, is around the state of the archaeological market, and that was released last year. So I suppose that'd be great if you could give us a brief overview of that document, and indeed the what's happening within archaeology currently.
So archaeology is a big sector across the UK. Around 6,600 people are employed in archaeology, and around 4,700 people work in UK commercial archaeology. And the UK commercial archaeological sector in the report was valued at around £250 million turnover a year. So yeah. I'm not quite sure how that compares with piling sector or other parts of engineering, but it's a
piling's about £1 billion a year industry. Yeah. At the moment, that has increased significantly in the last year, mainly due to HS2, which we'll come on to later. Typically it's around £600 million.
And so that work breaks down, about a third of that work goes into projects that are around residential development, about a third of that is around transport, so new roads, railways like HS2. And then the final third is around commercial, so office buildings, large industrial estates, energy, water and minerals.
Mm. And do you find that skewed geographically towards London, or is that fairly evenly spread throughout the country?
Infrastructure projects definitely help, because they create those sort of long bands of work or sort of areas where you do see a little bit more happening. But there's, you know, there is a lot of development taking place across the country, and certainly the team I manage, we do see variety in what's happening. So, you know, the country, the archaeology in the country is different. The nature of that archaeological record is different in different places because of the geology, because of the way people have settled and changed the landscape over time. And the nature of the development impacts are different in different places. So, you know, where you will see different pressures on that archaeological resource. So you might not see as many big infrastructure projects, but you might see more housing somewhere, or you might see more coastal development in other places. So there's a lot of work going on across the country. It might just be different types of that work taking place.
Yeah, I suppose you also look at where they settlements. So, for instance, I'm not far from Colchester here, which obviously has got a huge history from the Roman age. And so there must be little areas in the country that you really want to find out a lot more about. And you know that it's physically, it's buried quite deep in the ground, the developments from those ages. The other thing I'm thinking is, what is of archaeological importance? Because we're obviously thinking about the history. Could something within the last 100 years still be historically important? I'm guessing it could. Where do you draw the line in terms of the investigations and the preservation of these works?
I mean, archaeology is the study of the past through looking at material culture, through looking at the things people made, the places they lived, the landscapes they lived in. And so you can study the archaeology of something that happened 20 years or 30 years ago. Whether that's of interest and significance, you know, will depend on what it is you're studying. You can study the archaeology of the post-medieval brick industry. And the further back you go with your study, the rarer particular examples of that will become, because they've been lost through development, through changes. So if you're looking at a particular industry, you might have a site that's been making, so let's say, stick with bricks, been making bricks for 300 or 400 years. A lot of the evidence of that early brick making on that site will have been lost as that brick, you know, as that business has grown and developed. And so you might only, for example, have, you know, evidence from the 19th century, the 17th century evidence being lost. So if you find 17th century evidence on that site, that's obviously would be of greater significance because of its rarity.
But who's the arbiter? Who determines, right, this is significant enough, we need to keep it. This is okay because it was, I don't know, it was just a low-rise residential development from the 1980s. There's thousands of them. Is there a manual that we can refer to go, right, it's okay, guys, we got thousands of these things. Let's just pull it out of the ground. Is it more subjective than that?
One of the roles that Historic England has is in recommending to government historic assets to be listed. And we do that through a series of criteria, which look at things like the rarity, the significance, the survival. And so through that, we create a national list of sites that are designated, be they historic buildings, registered parks or gardens, scheduled ancient monuments or battlefields. And that process recognises the most important heritage sites. There are lots of sites that fall out of that sort of envelope of being of the most importance. But obviously, certainly for archaeological sites, we haven't found all those sites. There's still many sites that are still to be uncovered. And through that process of investigation and evaluation, the developer's archaeologist is then looking at the evidence they've got and making assessments as to whether they feel that what they've got in front of them is of national significance or regional significance. And then the developer is then working with the local authority to decide how to progress with that site and the best way to ensure that if it's of national significance, that significance is retained through the development, if possible.
Jim, how did you start getting involved with the construction industry?
Well, I think people sometimes talk about those career-changing roles that they get in life, and that happened to me just after I'd finished my PhD at Sheffield. There was a postdoc opportunity in the engineering department working for Professor Adrian Hyde and Dr. Charles Hurd, writing project designs to submit to the EPSRC to look at engineering impacts on archaeological remains. And I was lucky enough to get the job. And it was quite a change, a move from working in an archaeological department where you turned up in your second best T-shirt to move to working in an engineering department where you turned up looking a lot smarter. And I took that, you know, really took that on board, and I think it's, you know, it's been a key.
Hence the tie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the famous orange tie, which you we discussed, I think.
Yeah. So that was my first foray into engineering, and I spent 5 months in the department writing a couple of project designs, which were funded, and so they had 3 or 4 years of research looking at piling in layered ground to look at the potential impacts on drawing down deposits adjacent to the piles and what impact that might have on archaeology there, and also looking at compression impacts on archaeology. And it was great for me. I got to hang out with engineers and engineering students. I got to attend a fantastic steel piling conference in Scunthorpe, where I got to go and actually see steel piles being made, which is a phenomenal process. But also meet exhibitors there and hear about kind of steel piling research. And shortly after,
is this for offshore piling or
they were sheet piles,
right? Okay.
Shortly after that, I got a job at Historic England, or English Heritage as it was called then, as a science advisor, which is the role I've had sort of pretty much for the last 20 years. And I brought into that role my understanding of construction impacts on archaeology and on piling. And a lot of the early years of my work, we were looking at some of those issues around how do you build buildings on archaeological sites? How do you manage to put up a building without damaging the archaeology. And in 2007, I was working with a couple of colleagues, Jane Stell and Ian Panter, to produce the first copy of the guide, Piling and Archaeology Guidance. And you'll probably remember that one. It had the striking cover image of the pile going through the middle of the skeleton.
In fact, in the latest document, I think the image is still retained. And, yeah, literally going through the head of the skeleton, isn't
yeah.
it? And then you've got the body just got the legs remaining.
Sticking out.
Yeah.
And so we've been working in 2009 to update that document to reflect the big changes that had really happened in planning policy over those those 12 years. But I felt when we came to do this sort of revision, I didn't really want to go through that process of creating something and then sending it out and like having your homework marked. But I wanted to try and have a more collaborative exercise. So we're able to work with Tony Suckling, Chris Barker, Chris Oram, and Chris Robinson, and actually bring them into the authoring process. So we approached the BGA, who gave us these names, and got together with those guys and some archaeologists who work in local authorities, some archaeologists working on archaeological excavations, including the people that found Richard III, and some archaeologists from Historic England who work on archaeology for us as well. And we looked at the document, had a bit of a telephone meeting because it was pre-Zoom, pre-Teams, talked about what we felt was right about it, what was wrong, we wanted to get rid of. I kind of pulled that together into a bit of a sort of hit list of action paper. And then we all got together in London one day. We sat down in different groups, mix of people in each group, and just worked through each section, revising it, rewriting it, swapping over. So we had a really collaborative exercise in producing the document. And so it's not something that's written by me. It's not something that's written by 15 people. We're all kind of co-authors on that because I think it's a really important way of actually recognising how integrated it needs to be, and why not design the document from that way forward. And I think a testament to the approach we took was that when we then went out to consultation, we didn't have that same level of kind of comments from the sector saying, well, you know, you've missed this out, you've not got this right, because we'd done so much of that consultation in advance. The initial document, the emphasis was really on just trying to understand the impact of different piling techniques. We were still, as a sector, not really sure what, you know, we didn't really understand what piling was all about. And so it was useful to explain the different pile types and the different impacts they would have. And the guidance was really about trying to keep that impact as low as possible, sort of to try and minimise it to only being sort of 5%. And we were working in a policy kind of area of planning guidance, which was PPG 16, which was introduced in 1990. And it brought with it that sort of concept of developer-funded archaeology and of the developer paying for archaeology. But it also brought in this presumption in favour of the physical preservation of nationally important archaeology. And so there was some really good examples of archaeologists and engineers working together to try and design foundation solutions that preserved archaeology and still allowed buildings to be built. But there was also some other examples of people carrying out limited archaeological excavations, finding they've got Roman material, and then saying, OK, well, we know that's Roman, it must be nationally important, we'll just put some piles in, and then designing a very rigid sort of grid of piles and just dropping them straight in. And we got to a point where I think as a sector we were content, and perhaps not content, but we accepted that as long as you could put 5% less or less damage in, you could just put some piles in. And then, you know, thinking about that, people were clear that you weren't really thinking about what impact those individual piles might be having, or what, you know, not really thinking about the cumulative impacts that might have happened in the past and the damage that might have already gone on.
So the idea was, in a sense, piles were a better foundation solution than pad foundations.
No, I think we would have always accepted a pad foundation or a strip foundation rather than piled foundation, but often it was about trying, the guidance really was trying to deal with those situations where you were getting a piled foundation solution. Okay. And then more recently, the planning guidance, the NPPF, it's got a different emphasis. You know, it puts a much greater weight on assessing the significance of heritage assets and reducing harm to that significance. And so we wanted to update the guidance to take that on board. And really what that meant for archaeology is getting archaeologists to understand more about what's on the site, to characterise those remains better, to understand which bits had the greatest significance, and to try and find ways to avoid harming that significance. And so that meant collecting better information about the site, collecting it early so it can be shared with engineers, so that together they can come up with sustainable foundation solutions.
So the target audience for this document is quite broad. It's for engineers working in the piling sector. It's for structural engineers, maybe architects as well, who have I missed?
Yeah.
Was it site investigation companies even?
Absolutely. I think we recognise that by the time we're talking to piling contractors, if that's the first set of people we're talking about the archaeology on site, it's too late, because they've turned up and they've got a piling plan. They've already been commissioned. And, you know, by that point, it's very difficult to make decisions about what you can move, where you can move it to, because, you know, the piling plan's, you know, based on the design above that. So it is about getting in much earlier, so there's much earlier dialogue. We can be talking about what the constraints are on a site and how to design around it. In the piling and archaeology guidance, there's a really good example from Leicester, which is a city with really deep Roman and medieval history. And at a site, there's crossroads between Vaughan Way and Highcross Street. And the excavations that were evaluations carried out by University of Leicester Archaeological Services, they looked across the site and they tried to understand which areas had already been subject to previous development and impacted there. There was also evidence of medieval quarrying, where they'd just come along to the site to quarry out bits of gravel or bits of Roman building. And then worked with the client to design foundations that would go in the areas of impact rather than in the areas where we knew we had well-preserved archaeology. And there were some bits of the site where it was very difficult to reconcile that. You had to have a lift shaft there. So, you know, we had a limited targeted excavation in those aspects. But it just showed what you could get by having that decent level of investigation early enough that you could then have that dialogue.
It wasn't the one where they found Richard the Lionheart, was it? Was it?
No, that was around the corner.
Oh, okay. Well, that got, did I read correctly? They proved that it wasn't him after all, it's somebody else. Did I see that? Maybe not. Okay. Jim's shaking his head. I'll have to check my sources on that. I thought the idea had been dismissed as not necessarily a hoax, but perhaps a coincidence of DNA and so on. So the document, you worked together with people from the industry, Tony Suckling, that we mentioned before, that you worked with. You also worked with Chris Barker from Arup, who's closely engaged with the FPS as an associate member, and a couple of other individuals. Reminded Chris Oram, wasn't it, who was at Roger Bullivant. I think is at Frankie at the moment. Chris is our the FPS's technical vice chair, and so I've missed somebody else that was involved in that report. Which Chris have I missed?
Chris Robinson, Jim? From Cementation
Chris. There you go. Shout out to Chris as well. So thanks for their involvement in that. Perhaps Jim, you can give us a summary of the impact of different piling types. So if historic England, forget the ground engineering aspects of it in terms of how important they are. Is there a particular type of pile that you would prefer to see on a site where there's historic remains? If you could have your choice of pile, which one would you go for and why?
Sounds very, very blind date, Silla, doesn't it?
That? It does. Oh, I miss those days.
I think if you'd have asked me that when we'd written our first draft of the piling and archaeology guidance, we'd have said, well, we don't really like driven piling because you get a much bigger area of influence around that that's damaged. And I guess so the big shift in emphasis in the new guidance is really what we're saying is that it's about choosing the right piling type for the situation that you're in and designing a foundation solution that would do the least harm. So if you can design a solution that puts piles where there's no archaeology or the archaeology that there is of low significance or it's already been damaged, then in fact it doesn't really matter what pile type you use. It's about understanding what the different impacts of those piles might be on the archaeological remains. So it's about taking much more of a risk assessment methodology and following that through.
So it might be better to have a smaller number of larger diameter or deeper piles, for instance, in a location where, you know, you're not going to go through an old Roman wall and then have quite a big span to the next location that's clear from any artifacts, and span it like that rather than having, as we often see for economic reasons, clusters of piles.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got an archaeological site with a lot of archaeology going on, and you're trying to find ways to micro-site your piles, then clearly having the fewest number of piles and having them, you know, kind of finally located in the areas of least significance will be the preferable solution. Because obviously if you've got four piles in a cluster, the impact that they do to the archaeology and also the impact that they do to being able to understand that archaeology if you come back in 30 or 40 years and try and look at it will obviously be quite high, and almost the same level of loss as if that was one big pile that was there in the first place.
Okay. And I think our discussion at the piling conference recently was around pile reuse. Where does this document sit within Rufus and that document, and why is it important to understand exactly where we're installing new foundations? Because I think we can be pretty safe in saying that actually pile foundations for structures we're creating now won't be that important in 400 years time. I don't know that people are going to be preserving CFA and driven steel piles that we've constructed in the last 20 years. They won't be protecting those in 400 years time, will they?
I was lucky enough to be involved with the Rufus project through a chance meeting at a conference. Someone put me in touch with Tony Butcher at the BRE, and so I spent some time working with them and went to a few of their meetings. And actually, that it was an excellent opportunity of being in the right place at the right time. Also met Tim Chapman and Sarah Anderson, who are writing the Syria Foundation Reuse Guide, and managed to persuade them to part with a data stick with the document, with the nearly complete draft document on it, on the bus ride back from that meeting in Linköping in northern Sweden, with the promise that by the time we got off the plane at London, they would have a completed archaeology section written for them, ready to drop into the document. So, that was a good way of getting engaged with the process. Foundation reuse is really important for archaeological sites. There are a lot of foundations that have been driven, bored, excavated, dug, built into archaeological sites over the last 100, 200 years. And so where we can reuse those foundations in new buildings that are going up now, then obviously that's having a big impact on, that's stopping us from putting new ones in, that's limiting the damage to archaeological sites. And the Historic England Piling and Archaeology Guidance is really clear that what we would like to see much more of is foundation reuse feasibility studies taking place before buildings are coming down, so that the outcome of those studies are influencing the design of the above ground buildings, so that people are thinking from the ground up, they're thinking about the importance of preserving the archaeology on site as part of that development process. And even if they can't just reuse those foundations, they're looking at how to build those foundations into the rest of their foundation plan so that they can limit the number of new foundations that are going in there.
Yeah, so if we reuse the old foundations, it means that there's less disturbance potentially to this historic, historically important things that are in the ground. And yeah, that goes forward. So if we keep a good record, if we have robust foundation systems, then it means that the next several evolutions of the building, because let's face it, probably most buildings are going to be up for, what, 50, maybe 100 years. In that 400 years in the future, if we can reuse the foundations we're putting in now several times, then it means less disturbance to those remains.
Absolutely, and I think the big change between, you know, the point where we've produced our first guidance and our most recent update is that we're now pushing in a much more open door. You know, sustainability and net zero are bigger drivers than they were when Rufus project was taking place. And, you know, the other driver is, you know, particularly in big urban areas, is congestion, ground congestion from existing piles. So, yeah, we're very keen on trying to make sure that the reuse of new foundations for the future is properly planned in, that, you know, there may be being over-engineered to take larger loads in the future, and critically that record keeping, you know, is a key part of that, and that, you know, clients, designers see those records as being really important elements of how their building operates, that landowners see those records as being a key part of that land ownership and that building refreshment rate.
Yeah, kind of pulled in two directions there, really. So you're trying to be more sustainable, use less carbon, but also have something that future-proofs the foundation system. So that means putting in potentially deeper piles or more piles. There's some really difficult decisions for ultimately the clients are going to be the ones paying for it. There's no easy answers in that regard, I'm afraid. But it's a great document. Recommend all of our listeners to check out the Rufus guidance. You mentioned Tim Chapman. So Tim was actually the guest on the first podcast that I did. I'm really, really proud of that episode. Obviously testing out my podcasting host skills for the first time there, but thankfully Tim did a lot of talking and is a really great guest to have on. So he does talk on that episode a lot about sustainability in general, but the Rufus project in particular. You're doing a lot of work at the moment. It's a great opportunity as well as for the piling sector, for the archaeological sector, when we're involved with this mega scheme HS2, could you tell us a little bit about the sorts of things that you're finding on that scheme and the scale of the work that's going on?
Yeah, as you say, HS2 is a boon for piling contractors. It's certainly been a welcome opportunity for archaeologists as well. And Historic England is works very closely with HS2 as the government's advisor. On the historic environment, we work to give advice to HS2. And for the last 10 years, that's been one of the mainstays of my role. So I've got to see firsthand, really, the huge amount of work that's been going on. And that has been a long process of investigation, of desk-based work, of remote sensing, of aerial remote sensing, of ground-based geophysics, boreholes, evaluations, and then excavations. And obviously HS2, as with many other developers, have a key kind of goal of minimising environmental harm. And obviously archaeology is a key part of that. But we're dealing with a very straight, constrained site, unlike a development where you could say, well, could I microsite my pile away from that Roman wall to this area where there isn't any archaeology, it's not so easy to just wiggle a high-speed railway around an archaeological site. So there is inevitably, you know, a certain amount of excavation that's going on, and so we've had some fantastic finds from post-medieval burial grounds, a large medieval burial ground with a disused church that's pulled down in the 60s that was excavated. Underneath that, they found a Roman mausoleum. That was a very excellent find, which was in the news recently. Excavated an awful lot of Roman settlements, certainly a couple of Roman edges of Roman towns and small Roman farmsteads. There was a beautifully preserved sort of 2-foot-tall Roman timber figure, which had been preserved in a waterlogged ditch. And you could see the beautiful carving on it, a sort of a tunic with a sort of band across, like an early runner's sort of top.
Romans, what do they ever do for it? I mean, it's just continually, it comes up. I think because it seems that like they were such an advanced civilization compared to certainly where we were as a country back in what year did they come to Britain?
AD 43.
Oh gosh, I'm miles out. and then of course we went into the what we call the Dark Ages. Did we just forget all the lessons? Sorry, I'm really going into history here rather than archaeology. Did we just forget all the lessons the Romans taught us and all the engineering that they brought to this country? And that all left when they had to go because of all the problems back in Rome or wherever. Why did... did the country regress? And do you see that reflected in the sort of remains that you dig up?
Well, I think that really has been the case with the sites that they've had on HS2, that you've got so many Roman sites, and pretty much all of them have, you know, they peter out. We end up with very little evidence on them after the 3rd or 4th century. There just seems to be a huge decline. There's very little Saxon early medieval evidence on most of those sites. We have found some evidence of early medieval activity on the route. There's a nice early medieval burial ground with lots of well-preserved finds from it, spears and pottery and glass vessels. But by and large, it's not a period that reveals itself very often on archaeological sites.
No, it's poor by comparison, isn't it, when you think of the, you know, viaducts or aqueducts that the Romans built, and it had sort of geothermal things going on. It's incredible technology that the Romans brought to us, and that just disappears. So no wonder we're all so fascinated by it. Is there something that you would say that you particularly learnt about history from the projects that have gone on? Is there things that really stand out that point to something that we, you know, collectively we didn't know before about our ancestors?
On one level, the project's still in its early phases of looking at that information. So a lot of the archaeological excavation has taken place, and there's still a lot of the post-excavation assessment and analysis that's still got to be undertaken, which will really draw out some of those key lessons and learning. I think the big thing is that we've learned is just how many sites there were in an area that was seemingly quite blank. The route of HS2 does not go through very developed areas, obviously, because it's deliberately chosen to avoid areas of previous development. But there are still, you know, a Roman site every 3 or 4 miles, it seems. I mean, maybe not quite that many, but there's still a lot of evidence out there, and it's been really fascinating to try and understand more about how that, you know, rural environment works.
Yeah, and I see a note here that you'd made about the Roberts Robert Stevenson's round house, which obviously doesn't date back to Roman times, but nevertheless, I'm sure quite an interesting project for you.
There have been obviously quite a lot of archaeological sites that have been excavated because they've been in the main line, but wherever possible, HS2's been working along with its contractors to design out impacts where they're off the line, but within areas of their land take. And one of the ways they've done that is through preservation of areas, trying to take areas out of the scheme, look at ways they can reduce the impact of building their compounds, or trying to find different ways to create their environmental offset areas. But we've got a certain number of schemes where we've been working with engineers to look at how we can preserve archaeology underneath design elements. So we've had a couple of sites where there's embankments that have been built over the archaeology. So we've been working hard with engineers to look at settlement distribution and settlement data under those embankments and understand whether the archaeology that's going to be underneath them will be robust enough to be preserved within, you know, left underneath the embankment. And that's been really interesting. And as you say, we've got the Robert Stevenson's roundhouse. It's the first engine shed built in the world. And HS2 were aware that it was on the route. It's adjacent to where the new station will be in Birmingham. But when they undertook the excavation, I think everyone was surprised by the level of survival. We've got some really good original plans of the building, and we've got it's shown on a number of early maps. But because it was designed for those very small train engines that you see, obviously once engines start getting bigger, it was no longer a useful size and shape. So it quickly becomes replaced. And like all railway areas, you know, the amount of development and redevelopment and change that goes on as the railways evolve was quite considerable. It then ends up underneath the Royal Mail sorting office, parcel office, and then becomes a car park. So 150 years later, 120 years later, peeling all that off and discovering the cast concrete turntable base and an array of inspection pits, brick inspection pits, with drainage features all around, was quite phenomenal. So HS2's contractors, LM, worked with their engineer to carry out a condition assessment, a chap called Matthew Pettigrew. And so he worked around the site, looked to see what of that material was fragile, what needed protecting, what could be safely reburied and was robust enough to be put underneath some sort of sand and other lay down materials. And so a really detailed process of trying to understand the site, understand any issues with burying that, design some protection measures, so some sort of concrete blocks that sat over the most fragile areas, and then process of reburying with sand and then sub-base and other fill material so that the area could be used over the next 4 or 5 years as a lay-down area for station construction. And that involved a lot of detailed discussion, not just about the whether or not we could put all that material on there, but also what was the right material to use. So choosing the right sand for the backfill that wouldn't impact on the archaeology. And that was a real balance, an environmental balance of getting sand that was able to be won on site. Would that be suitable versus did they need to bring sand in with all the obvious environmental impacts of trucking that into site and things? So.
Yeah, it must be a real challenge to preserve some of these things, particularly, for instance, where it's a wooden building, changing the moisture content around it. We saw years ago with a Mary Rose that when they brought that to the surface, that they had to have it in this structure. So this is the boat from Tudor times that was found near Portsmouth, and they had to constantly spray it with presumably seawater to keep it in the state it was brought up in, so it just didn't rot away. And you must have similar sorts of challenges.
Well, I think there are sites that are nice and easy. So things that are made of brick and concrete that are certainly much there are fewer considerations than when you get a site where you've got waterlogged material, where you've got more fragile remains, where you're not trying to, not just worrying about the material in its structure, but you're also worrying about trying to keep the same ground environment and the same groundwater conditions. And one of the sites on the route was a medieval moated site. So kind of, it would have had a building in the middle. It's got a moat around it, had some fish ponds. And the route was going to go past there on a on an embankment. And the concern was whether building that would impact on the hydrogeological regime and lead to any changes in groundwater. And obviously the worry being, if the groundwater level dropped, then wooden remains that were preserved within, say, the moat or on the site might have dried out. So hydrogeologists from LM and then the main works contractor, BBV, worked really hard to design, to understand the hydrogeological settings. So they carried out water environment studies. They looked at where the water was coming from, how it was getting into the moat, what influenced those water levels, and then used that information to design the right sort of solution for culverts underneath the embankment so that that water level would be maintained during and after the construction of the embankment and into its use.
Gosh, so much to think about. Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been a lot of fun and really informative talking to you today. Thanks so much for coming on. I'm off now to go and brush up on my history. Rather embarrassed about my knowledge of the Roman Empire, but you know, we're all on a journey to learn more about history. So mine really kicks in now. So thanks for giving me that push.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you.
I hope that you've enjoyed listening. If you did, then please subscribe. You can also go to geplus.co.uk for more ground engineering and geology news. Thank you.